Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from WETS FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Now let me ask you a question. Do you plan on voting in the presidential election this November? Are you sure? Let me ask you something else. Will your vote count? And the answer to that question is actually pretty constitutional because, of course, if you live in Tennessee, any vote for anybody except Mitt Romney is likely to, in some sense, be wasted. And if you're in North Carolina, well, maybe that's a little different. Certainly in Virginia it is, because those states are toss-up states in the Electoral College. Now, the Electoral College is not something that most people who study constitutional law spend an awful lot of time on, but it's something that becomes very important every 4 years, and especially every few decades when we have a really close presidential race. Where were you in November of 2000 when the Bush-Gore race came to its climactic head? That's the first time I really thought about it, and it was probably because, like most Americans, I went to bed thinking that Al Gore had won the election, and I woke up, well, not knowing who won the election, and like most of you, had to wait several weeks to find out. I happened to live in Florida at the time, and realizing how historic this was, I actually participated in, at least as an observer, the 2000 Florida recount, and I dragged along with me a little fellow who in the ensuing 11 years has grown to be a young man. His name is Benjamin Harris. Hello, Ben.
Hey, Dad.
And I've known him for many years, as his calling me Dad just has told you all. Ben is, in fact, my younger son. And just last year, he wrote an excellent term paper on the Electoral College. And so I invited him today to give us the basic explanation. Ben, what is this Electoral College?
Well, the Electoral College is the system that we in America use to elect our president. When you go to the polls, you might see the two names on there and think you're actually directly voting for the candidate. But in reality, you're voting for an elector who's pledged to vote for that candidate in the election that really matters, the election that takes place later in December where the electors get together and cast their electoral votes for the president.
Where does this Electoral College come from?
Well, it comes from Article 2, the second paragraph of the Constitution dealing with the executive branch. And I'll read it. Each state shall appoint, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct, a number of electors, equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in that Congress. But no senator or representative, or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States, shall be appointed an elector. And then it continues to describe what shall happen in the event of a tie and what happens with a vice presidency. But that was all reformed in a rather lengthy amendment, the 12th Amendment to the Constitution.
Right. There's a lot more detail, and the 12th Amendment has superseded most of what follows in Section 2
exactly.
of Article 2. But you've gotten the gist of it. That first part has not been changed.
No. And we still use that to elect our president today.
Why did we invent this special system where we didn't vote directly for the president but had this group of people between us and the presidency?
Well, just looking at it, it may not make much sense, but in terms of the Constitutional Convention in 1787, it was a major compromise of the convention. It wasn't the first option. It wasn't even the second. It was the third option considered at the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
The first two was appointing the president by Congress through the legislative branch. The second was a direct election, and the third was this intermediary approach through the Electoral College.
Why didn't they use either the direct election or using Congress?
Well, the framers were facing five major issues at the time for the election of the president. The first one was the degree of executive authority the president would have. And since the Articles of Confederation failed miserably without no central executive, most framers wanted a strong executive, and they felt they wouldn't have that if the legislature appointed the president.
Too much control if the legislature elected him.
Exactly.
Okay.
There is also the problem of suffrage, who exactly would be voting, and the problem of the mob rule is what the framers feared. They were an aristocratic group of people, mm-hmm. and they didn't feel like the common man really knew enough about the president. So that really eliminated the direct election approach.
Okay.
But they also had three other major issues, though. Large states versus small states.
Right.
Where small states wanted, you know, voting based on a state basis.
Right. They were afraid they'd be overwhelmed by a direct election, right?
Exactly. And so...
Because when we talk about small states, we mean small in population.
Small in population.
Right, yeah. They didn't want direct elections because they okay.
Yeah, so you had the entire, you know, Connecticut Compromise where you have the bicameral legislature.
Right.
With senators and representatives. And the Electoral College just carried that compromise through.
I see, okay.
And the small states got another concession, and that is in the event of a tie, the election would be thrown to the House of Representatives. But, and here's the key, each delegation would vote by state, not by member. So a small state has just as much voice as a big state in the event of a tie in the Electoral College.
So like so much in the Constitutional Convention, this Electoral College was a compromise that nobody was really satisfied with.
Exactly. The other two issues, the slavery, again, the three-fifths compromise, like the Connecticut Compromise, just carried over because
right.
the way electors were appointed.
Right. And so this is another way in which the South was able to maintain power despite having a lower number of freeholding voters.
Exactly. In a direct election, there are not going to be many white male free landowners in Virginia. But if they do it based on their representatives in Congress, they suddenly have a much bigger voice.
Because they've brought in those three-fifths that they had for their representative elections.
And calculate that in the number of electors.
I see. Okay.
And the last issue was sectionalism. And this is the biggest issue for the framers.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them thought that, you know, there are 13 different states. And they thought each year there'd probably be 13 different nominees for president.
Because
mm-hmm. they really hadn't anticipated the rise of the political party system where you have, you know, the two major candidates.
Right.
And so they thought, well, from year to year, the House of Representatives is going to be deciding who's president 19 times out of every 20.
Jeez.
And so they really felt that the Electoral College would be a stable method instead of maybe the large states just being able, with the population centers, to decide who's the next president from among these 13 candidates.
Right. We had Professor Beeman, Richard Beeman, who wrote Plain Honest Men in here a while ago, and he said that really was the big issue. They were so concerned about sectionalism because in those days, people from one part of the nation didn't even know who the candidates were from the other part. And so they were very concerned that you would have just a multiplicity of candidates and that everybody would vote for his own state representative.
And that's perhaps the most important part of the 12th Amendment,
mm-hmm.
which stipulates not the 12th Amendment, but of the
original Article 2, yeah.
Which stipulates that when you're voting for president and vice president, you cast two ballots. And the important aspect of that is that one of the two ballots you're casting has to be for someone outside of your own state. So they thought,
right.
Well, they're all going to pick the state's favorite son with one of the ballots, and maybe one of those will be a vice president. But at least the president will be a guy with, you know, continental appeal. Who each of the other people can say, well, that's a good second choice for president, so I'll pick this guy with my second ballot, and he'd wind up being the president of the United States.
Okay. What's the problem? I mean, why do we care if this Electoral College, which is the product of compromise like so much else in the Constitution, why do we care if it stays the same or if we want to change it?
Well, there are a lot of differences between now and when the framers made it. Most notably, I mean, you have the political parties coming mm-hmm. around. You have a better informed populace. And you also have the rise of the, you know, all-or-nothing electoral vote system.
The all-or-nothing electoral vote system. What's that?
Well, that's when the winner of the majority election in Tennessee, for example,
mm-hmm.
all of Tennessee's electoral votes go to that candidate.
Wait a minute. That's not specified in the Constitution?
The Constitution only specifies that the state legislatures get to appoint their state's electors.
However they wish.
Exactly. And in the original elections, most of the state legislatures just decided who the electors would be without the people involved at all.
Wow.
And so it's only over time that the general election across the state rose to prominence,
mm-hmm.
and then gradually the all-or-nothing system rose to prominence because that would inflate the power of each individual state. They'd give more electoral clout to that state.
I see.
And to the party in power.
So they didn't apportion their votes based on the popular vote. They simply said, if we've got 51% who want this candidate, then all of our electoral votes go.
Exactly. In the 1800 election, Virginia normally did a district plan where each district would vote separately and each elector would be responsible to the district.
Mm-hmm.
The 1800 election was a very close election between the Federalist John Adams and the Virginian Republican,
mm-hmm.
Thomas Jefferson. So what did Jefferson do? He talked to his buddies in the state legislature and said, we need to use a general ticket system for Virginia to make sure basically that all the electors go for me. for Thomas Jefferson.
And Hamilton did the same thing up in New York.
Exactly.
Because when one state does it, the other states want to do it because they want to have all their votes one way or the other.
Well, in fact, in the bill in Virginia that introduced this general ticket system, actually the preamble condemns such a system. But it goes on to say when 10 of the states are doing it, it's folly for the other six not to. Because then their voice is not as great.
Okay. And as we all know from the 2000 election, occasionally when you count votes this way and you go state by state and you have this all or nothing rule, occasionally the candidate who has the most votes across the nation considered as a whole actually ends up with fewer electoral votes.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest problem that most people perceive.
That's the biggest problem. And it was just brought to our attention in 2000, but it actually happened four times in our nation's history.
Good heavens. Well, we'll talk about that later. But in the meantime, we've got a couple of experts we're going to talk to about this subject, because as you might guess, there's some very strong opinions on both sides of this. Now, the first of these two experts is a fellow by the name of John Koza. And he's a math guy, so I want to warn you, he's going to talk a little bit about different ways to add things up and their effects, but he's very clear, and you can follow what he has to say. He's very impressive. He has a PhD in computer science from the University of Michigan. He's published a board game involving electoral college strategy. He's the co-founder, chairman, and CEO of Scientific Games, Inc., where he invented all kinds of interesting stuff, including the rub-off lottery ticket used by state lotteries. And he has, well, I'll let him tell you more about what he's done with regard to the Electoral College. Very impressive fellow, John R. Koza.
Thank you for inviting me, Stuart.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to have you here. Now tell me, you're a math guy. How did you get involved in Electoral College issues?
Well, when I was in college, we used to play all kinds of complicated board games, and while I was in college, we actually published a very complicated board game in the 1960s about manipulating battleground states in the Electoral College. So my interest in sort of the mathematics and the strategy of the Electoral College goes back to college days.
So wait a minute. You know, most guys in college are sitting around drinking beer and chasing women, and you were designing games about the Electoral College?
Well, I didn't say we weren't doing other things, but we did spend an inordinate amount of time playing a wide variety of strategy games.
I see. All right. So, okay, so you're a gamer, and you like the math part of it, and so somehow you got interested in the Electoral College.
Correct.
Great. Well, then what happened? What did you conclude about the Electoral College after you studied it a while?
Well, what was obvious in the 60s, and it's actually become worse in the last few decades, is that there's two major problems with the current system of electing the president. First, there's the obvious problem that in four of 56 presidential elections, the second place candidate ended up in the White House. And the reason that happens is this winner-take-all rule, which are state laws that say that Tennessee's 11 electoral votes will go to the candidate who gets the most votes inside the state of Tennessee. And because of that state-by-state zeroing out of the opposition, you can have odd results, and we've had that in four out of 56 elections. But there's actually a bigger problem caused by the winner-take-all rule, and that is that two-thirds of the states, including Tennessee, are regularly ignored in presidential elections because a candidate has no reason to campaign in Tennessee or pay attention to Tennessee issues, because we know that the Republican is going to win more votes than the Democrat in the November presidential election. And similarly, if you go to Washington State, which is the same size as Tennessee, presidential candidates don't campaign there or pay attention to Washington State issues because the Democrat's going to win.
Now, yeah, there's nothing lonelier than being a Democrat in Tennessee, is there?
Well, McCain carried the state 58% to 42, so there are quite a few Democrats in Tennessee, but obviously there's a whole lot more Republicans, and it's the same in Washington State. Now, if you go to Missouri, which also has 11 electoral votes, 21 of the 300 post-convention visits that the candidates made were in the state of Missouri, whereas it was zero in Washington State and actually one in Tennessee. So here you have three states that have the same number of people and the same number of electoral votes, and Washington and Tennessee are totally ignored, and Missouri gets a lot of attention. And the reason it did is that McCain and Obama were running neck and neck. Missouri was a closely divided battleground state, and therefore the candidates paid attention to Missouri issues and campaigned there and organized there and visited there and met with a lot of people. So the biggest single problem, we think, of the current system is that two-thirds of the people of the country are simply left out of the presidential election because of this winner-take-all rule.
Well, that certainly is a very big concern. So if I understood you correctly, that means that not only do some states just get ignored, but effectively all those Democrats in Tennessee and all those Republicans in Washington state, for example, become disenfranchised. It really doesn't matter if they vote or not.
It doesn't matter whether they vote or not. And more interestingly, in effect, they're credited to the candidate they voted against. So the 1.1 million people in Tennessee who voted for Obama had their votes effectively counted towards McCain. And the similar high percentage of or the lower percentage of Republicans in Washington state had their votes counted towards Obama. So you get a lot of weird results. But basically, two-thirds of the people, 200 out of 300 million Americans, are really irrelevant in presidential elections. And they spend 98% of their time and money in just 15 battleground states. And those are the familiar states like Pennsylvania and Ohio and Florida, often Missouri, Colorado, and so forth.
Right. And so not only do those people in the other states get ignored during the election, but if the election involves an incumbent or if there's a president in office who is going to be running for reelection, arguably that affects their policies as well. They're going to try to adopt policies that favor battleground states in their reelection campaigns.
Well, that's true. And that's true of presidents of both parties. Mm-hmm. You can trace Obama or Bush's travels while they were president during their first four years, and it's almost exclusively in closely divided battleground states. So mm-hmm. It affects governing as well as the conduct of the campaign.
All right. Well, what's the solution to these problems then? You've mentioned that you're particularly concerned about the winner-take-all aspect of states. Before I let you answer that, though, let me elaborate a bit. Electoral law is largely a matter of state law. I mean, states themselves decide who gets to vote and under what circumstances they vote and how their individual state electoral votes are going to be awarded. And so given that general arrangement where states have a lot of say in how those electoral votes are divided up, what is the solution to this problem?
Well, it is a state power. In fact, it's an exclusive state power. The states solely decide how they award their own electoral votes. And in the first presidential election in 1789, there were only three states that used this winner-take-all rule. And all three of them happened to have repealed it within 20 years. And then later they came back to it. So it's purely a matter of state law. So we think the solution to the problem is that the presidency should go to the candidate who gets the most popular votes of the people in all 50 states, the same way we elect a governor of Tennessee or a U.S. senator of Tennessee or a state legislator or a mayor. The candidate with the most votes should win the office. And that can be accomplished through changes in state law. So, for example, 9 states have now passed the National Popular Vote Bill, which is our legislation. And our bill basically says that Vermont, which is one of the recent states that passed it, will give its 3 electoral votes to the presidential candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states. But it won't go into effect in Vermont until states having a majority of the electoral votes pass the same bill. The bill has been passed now in 9 states that have, 132 electoral votes, which is roughly half of the 270 that you need. So we're basically halfway through the process of getting the states one by one to switch from the winner-take-all rule to the rule by which all other offices are filled in the United States, namely the candidate with the most votes wins the office.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we're speaking to Dr. John R. Koza about the Electoral College and about some ideas he has for reforming it. After the break, we'll have our Constitutional quiz, and then we'll speak some more with Dr. John R. Koza. Stay tuned.
Vote for me, vote for me. I'm the one you can trust, you'll see. Play your part in democracy. It's election time again. Written in the manifesto that we'll do more than them, and we'll keep our word at least until we get to number 10. It'll cost you less in taxes if you mark your cross for us, and we'll deal with
Here, once again, that it's time for the Constitutional Quiz. The curtains have opened, the lights have come up, and onto the stage strides our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael. Kelly, are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
I'm well. How are things in Montpelier today?
Oh, you know, they like to say that Montpelier is just a squirrel's leap from heaven.
A squirrel's leap from heaven. Well, while I try to get that image in my mind, I will turn to our contestant and ask him to introduce himself and tell us where he is from.
I'm Travis Owen, and I'm from Phoenix, Arizona.
Phoenix, Arizona. I've never been to Phoenix.
It's really hot.
So I've heard. All right, on to the quiz, Kelly.
All right, here we go. Here to go back to an old Supreme Court case. The Supreme Court ruled in Plessy versus Ferguson that segregated facilities based upon A, race were constitutional, B, gender were constitutional, C, race were unconstitutional, or D, gender were unconstitutional. So we have race and gender being constitutional or race and gender being unconstitutional, and you need to select the correct answer to the question of the Supreme Court ruled in Plessy versus Ferguson that segregated facilities based upon what?
Well, I know it's not C or D. I feel like I read this case pretty recently, actually.
Oh, good for you, Travis.
Yeah, took some race theory courses in undergrad, so... But I'm going to have to go with A, race was constitutional, segregating for race was constitutional.
Okay, now before we confirm or deny this answer, tell us what you know about Plessy versus Ferguson. Why do you think that's what the holding was?
Well, I do remember, I believe it was Plessy R.V. Plessy was only an eighth black. And I do know that despite that fact... he was told to move, and then when
move from where? Where was he?
He was in a particular car on the train.
Okay, on a train,
and it was a white car. Mm-hmm. Even though he appeared white, he was asked to move cars. And from what I recall, then it went to court, and the decision was oftentimes forgotten about, or not necessarily forgotten about, but you know, kind of like in. Brown versus the Board of Education, Plessy v. Ferguson, from what I recall, wasn't exactly a very referenced case, and they didn't, you know, establish overruling it or anything like that. But I, from what I recall, I hope I'm right. I'm not positive, but I think it would be a race.
Okay. Kelly?
All right, Travis, well done, my friend. Congratulations for now a proud owner of a really cool T-shirt.
Hey, a really cool T-shirt indeed awaits you. And I'll simply amend slightly what you said. You're correct. Plessy versus Ferguson, I believe, is an 1896 case. And that's where the Supreme Court said that separate but equal facilities, specifically a train car, but you know, more generally, were okay constitutionally. And didn't violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It's among the more infamous cases in the Supreme Court's history, and it was the law of the land, and you were correct again, for a little over 50 years, or roughly 50 years, until Brown versus Board of Education came along in 1954. The only place where I think he got it a little bit incorrect was that the court in Brown was specifically considering whether Plessy should stay as good law or not, and it specifically overruled Plessy. So that was the difference. Plessy said separate but equal, and Brown said no, separate but equal is no longer constitutional. But you got the answer right, so all the rest of that really doesn't matter now, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Okay, thank you very much for playing, and thank you, Kelly.
Thank you. Have a squirrel's leap from heaven day.
All right, bye-bye.
It's your weekly constitutional, and we're talking to Dr. John R. Koza about his plan to reform the Electoral College. Well, that's very interesting, so let's make sure that I understand this now. Each individual state in our constitutional scheme has a lot of power over how it awards its electoral votes. And so rather than trying to amend the federal constitution, you're going to work within the current constitutional structure, and you're simply going to convince a certain number of those states to award their individual state electoral votes based not upon the majority within that state, but rather based upon the popular majority in the country as a whole. So, as you say, Vermont would simply hold off. It would simply say, well, you know, here's the vote in our state. The Democrat wins or the Republican wins in our state, but we're not going to award our electoral votes on that basis. We're going to wait and see how the rest of the nation votes, and then just depending on who gets the majority of the popular vote, we'll award our electoral votes on that basis.
That's correct.
Okay, and then your scheme will only, I don't mean scheme in a negative way, or your plan will only take effect once enough states have agreed to do this, so that if all of them do it, they will effectively elect the next president with at least 270 electoral votes.
Right. Vermont and the eight other states that have enacted this are not giving away their electoral votes unilaterally to the whim of other states. They're saying when enough states agree to the same approach and pass laws that say this, then at that time, when there's enough states with enough electoral votes to guarantee the White House, then at that point, they will give all of their electoral votes to the candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states.
But that would sure change election night, wouldn't it?
Well, it would change election night because, for one thing, every vote in every state would matter in every presidential election. So a vote in, Missouri, which has the same number of people as Tennessee, would suddenly become as important as the vote in Tennessee. Pardon me, I said that backwards. The vote in Tennessee would suddenly become as important as the vote in Missouri.
Yeah.
And therefore, there would have been a campaign in Tennessee. Presidential candidates would have come to Tennessee, focused on Tennessee issues. And frankly, most of the South is ignored in presidential elections, except for the occasional battleground state like Florida and sometimes Virginia and North Carolina, because most of the South generally votes Republican in presidential elections, and neither the Democrat nor Republican really cares about the issues in most of the southern states because they can't win any electoral votes by catering to southern states.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a fascinating and very interesting thing. When do you anticipate, I'm sure you're anticipating success, when do you anticipate you might get enough states to sign up for this that would actually go into effect?
Well, we're working in all of the remaining 41 states, and we're attempting to work state by state. We almost certainly won't get this finished in time for the 2012 election, but we think there's an extremely good chance to finish long before the 2016 election.
Well, that was a fascinating discussion with Dr. John R. Koza and his plan to substitute a national popular vote for our current Electoral College system. But as you might guess, other people disagree with him, and one of those people is a woman by the name of Tara Ross, who is a lawyer from Texas and who has written extensively about this very subject. We recently spoke to Ms. Ross about the Electoral College.
You know, we have such a big, diverse country with so many different regions and subcultures and interests. We need a unique election system if we're going to fairly represent this big country. You have to remember, the founders thought that 13 states was a big, diverse country that would need a unique form of representation. We are so much bigger and so much more diverse now. So I would say, if anything, the Electoral College has actually become even more useful in some regards than it used to be in the late 1700s.
Well, now, how does an electoral college that divides votes up on the basis of state lines, which to some extent are, you know, arbitrary, how does that better reflect our diversity than would a purely popular vote where everybody, no matter where he or she lives and whatever his individual views are, would be reflected on a vote-by-vote basis?
Well, you know what I think it does is it creates some sort of faction. You know, it's not a fact. There's actually a professor who's done a lot of work on this. Her name is Judith Best. She talks about how it's a safe faction upon which to rely. It's, you know, it's not just pro-life. It's not just pro-choice. It's not, you know, name your special interest group where people maybe tend to be unwilling to compromise across those lines. And a state is a safe group to rely upon, right? There are many different kinds of people in Texas. Maybe we are more like each other than a state like Rhode Island, but where I was born. But it gives you a safe way to have factions within the country that don't become so ingrained that they can't even talk to each other. And the other thing that it does is it gives us it forces candidates to prove that they can win multiple victories simultaneously in a bunch of different parts of the country. You can't just go camp out in the Midwest or wherever, name your region, name your urban area, and count on racking up a lot of votes there and expect those victories in one isolated part of the country to obtain the presidency for you. You have to prove that you can have broad-based appeal to a variety of people.
Well, but don't we just, as the current system stands, with most states on a winner-take-all basis, doesn't that effectively mean we've only got a handful of battleground states that get all the attention in presidential elections, and the rest of us, including your home state of Texas, pretty much get ignored? Because, I mean, they know you're going to vote Republican there.
Yeah, some people might be jealous that I don't have to watch all those ads all the time, right?
Yeah, you don't. I mean, how many times is either presidential elect in 2000? I guess our next election is in 2012. How many presidential election visits do you anticipate getting there in Texas? Like none?
Look, I think that if...
I don't think Barack Obama is going to show up in Texas too many times, do you?
Probably not.
Yeah.
I know that this is an argument that direct election opponents make, and they will say it's down to, I think, predictions for 2012 are like 7 states or 8 states or something like that. And say that those are the only states that matter. Well, look, you know, if you're going to talk about just one election year and focus on it in isolation, sure, you can say that. You can say that those are the only states that, quote, matter. But I think a better way to look at it is to say, look, these are the dynamics our presidential election system creates over time, over several elections, over the course of a generation or two. And if you look at the history of American voting, what you see is there's no such thing as a permanently safe state or a permanently swing state. You name Texas. Well, my state actually hasn't been Republican all that long. It wasn't that long ago that our state house was not Republican at all. And not that much further before that we were voting for Democratic presidents. California, same thing.
Well, now, there are Democrats and then there are Texas Democrats. And I don't think that the Texas Democrats were ever exactly what you'd call those Northeastern liberal Democrats.
So well, they were liberal enough to vote for Democratic presidents for a really long time.
Well, that may be true, mm-hmm. but seriously though, I mean, you're half of your voters or a significant portion of your voters in that state are effectively disenfranchised, and on the other hand, in another state, Republicans are disenfranchised. The state of Washington, for example, they never really get no one really pays any attention to them, and so how would it harm anything to give all those people an equal voice?
I disagree with that, because if they're not disenfranchised, and the reason they're not disenfranchised, they're just casting a ballot in a Texas state election or a California state election, and they happen to be on the losing side of the vote. Now, okay, so I'm from Texas. The Republicans here, if this had been a direct election system in 2008, and most of us had cast our ballots for John McCain as opposed to Barack Obama, would we say that all of those votes, that voters are disenfranchised because at the national level, they lost the campaign to Barack Obama. Either you cast a ballot on the losing side of an election or on the winning side of an election. There are winners and losers in every single election. The only difference here is that we are talking about whether we're going to have one national election with winners and losers or whether we're going to have 51 state and D.C. elections with winners and losers within each of those 51 elections that are being held in our country. The difference is not, you know, people like to say the Electoral College is undemocratic. It's not undemocratic. It's a question about, are you going to have pure democracy, one national democratic election, or are you going to have 51 democratic elections? Are we going to combine democracy with federalism? And I would argue there are important reasons, important benefits that we get from doing it in that 50 through those 51 processes instead of one process.
Okay, what are those benefits? Now, one of them you said was that you divided yourself up into benign factions, but beyond that, what are the benefits of having those 51 elections rather than just a single national election?
Well, I go back to, I think it forces presidential candidates to create a broad-based coalition, a coalition that takes into account many different types of regions in our country, many different types of industries, many different types of special interest groups, because those people are scattered across the country. Now, without the Electoral College, I would argue what would happen is, you know, there's no reason for Barack Obama and whoever the Republicans are going to be to go figure out some happy middle ground between many of these special interest groups or many of these regions, you know, between the environmentalists in California and the opposite in Texas, the oil guys or whatever you want to say.
Come on, you've got a few environmentalists in Texas, don't you?
There might be one or two.
Okay.
I heard they exist. I don't know.
All right. Your position is premised on the idea that if we abolish or effectively abolish the Electoral College with a national popular vote proposal, that will lead to a diminution of the importance of the two-party system.
Right. And I think the national popular vote people would actually agree with that.
Okay.
If there is a runoff. Now, they're saying that because there's no runoff, that's not going to happen to the degree that I say. I happen to disagree with that. I think that we will still see the two-party system be undermined. Now,
okay, and let me just finish the thought then. I want to make sure I understand your analysis. So if
sure.
we have, instead of two major party candidates, if we have three major candidates or mm-hmm. four or five,
right.
then in theory, the winner of the national popular vote would be the one with as little as, you know, 20 or 30% of the votes, because that's the plurality. That's simply the biggest vote getter. And
right.
that's a concern to you then.
Which you could get from a handful of big urban centers or a particular region or a particular special interest group. And so I think that what's going to happen in the very first election, are we going to totally fall apart and have 10 different candidates with 10% each or something? No, I don't think that's going to happen, because if nothing else, psychologically, we are so used as Americans to thinking in terms of a two-party system. But I also think that over time, that's what we're going to see. We're going to see this just chip away. I mean, there's a lot of people that would probably, you know, love it or hate it, would go vote for a Tea Party candidate right now, if they could, if they thought it would make a difference. There are people in this world who would want to go vote for someone like Ralph Nader or Ron Paul. I mean, you can easily come up with people who could have a legitimate shot at running for president. And if there was no electoral college system in place, it would be much harder to have a situation where you know that the winning candidate is going to have a really high plurality of votes, as somebody like, you know, George Bush did.
That puts it in stark terms. So your concern is that if we go to a popular vote, without any kind of runoff at least,
mm-hmm.
that we'll end up with either a Ron Paul or a Ralph Nader possibly as president.
I think that you're creating a situation where people don't have to build national coalitions in order to win the presidency. So I think what will happen is, instead of bringing Americans together and really kind of forcing us to focus on our similarities, or at least a middle ground where, you know, you grab more votes of the independents or whatever it is, I think you drive people to the extremes of their positions, because they have no reason to compromise anymore.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Texas attorney Tara Ross, who thinks that the Electoral College is a pretty darn good idea. After the break, we'll come back and find out what's happening this week at Montpelier, after which we'll speak some more with Tara Ross. Stay tuned.
I'm Kelly Carmichael from James Madison's Montpelier. What's happening out at Montpelier this week?
A very important constitutional event.
Oh, really? I didn't know there was an event of great constitutional significance. Okay, what's happening?
October 6th and 7th is our Fall Fiber Festival and Sheepdog Trials.
Our Fall Fiber Festival and Sheepdog Trials. Because, of course, fiber and sheepdogs were handled respectively in Articles 4 and 5
exactly.
of the original...
The Third Amendment. It's the updated Third Amendment.
It's the updated Third Amendment. It's not yet. Yeah, okay.
We've gotten rid of quartering of troops, so we're going to talk about
sheepdogs.
No, this is not a Constitution Day event or Constitution event, but it is an event that we host annually at Montpelier. It's a great Saturday and Sunday time to come and spend outdoors in the beautiful mm-hmm. fall when the leaves are changing. And
we're talking about border collies here, right?
Absolutely.
And they are some of the smartest dogs I'm aware of. I mean, apparently, and that's why they're used to herd sheep. And they actually bring sheep and dogs out here, and they actually herd them.
They herd them, and they do their exciting border collie trials, which is not, to me, in the Constitution world, is not putting them on trial. They're not with they will have judges, but not in the sense where they're...
No sheep is
going to
lose his life.
Okay. Or a prosecutor. or a law professor.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. No, you know, sometimes we have to remember that although our focus is on the Constitution, and that's certainly the nexus between Montpelier and James Madison and this show, is that the Madisons themselves, when they were here, I'm sure they spent many a weekend, you know, recreating, doing other things. I mean, there are horse races here. I mean, there are wine tasting festivals here. Not everything's about the Constitution. So this is just a fun fall. Weekend to come out and see something that maybe you haven't seen before. And certainly if you're a dog lover or a sheep lover, I suppose, this would be a good time to come.
Great time to come. And you can learn more at fallfiberfestival.org.
Fallfiberfestival.org. Okay. Thanks very much, Kelly.
Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're speaking with Tara Ross, the author of Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College. Ms. Ross shared with us that she's concerned that if we abolish the Electoral College, we might end up electing a president with a very small percentage of the vote.
Now, I'll say that's not my only concern with the National Popular Vote Plan. I have lots of legal concerns and logistical
concerns. Oh, well, please, tell us. We've spent a lot of time on that particular one. What are your other concerns?
Logistically, could be a huge nightmare. Logistically, the problem is that you have a situation where you are pretending like it's possible to hold one national election, but you're leaving 51, okay, so again, 50 states plus D.C., you're leaving 51 sets of election codes in place. Okay, now keep in mind, every state, there are some laws that govern the whole country, like how you submit your certificates, you know, electors' votes or whatever. But there are lots of things that are really, really different. There's different rules for early voting. There's different rules for how you get on a ballot. There's different rules about whether you let felons vote. There's different rules about how to count a hanging chad. You think about the relatively small problems that we had in Florida because of differences among counties about how they're implementing the same state's election code, basically. And then instead of that, you say, oh, now we have 51 sets of state and D.C. election codes, which are explicitly different, and we're going to pretend like it is possible to conduct a coherent national election with 51 sets of laws in place. That's crazy. There is just no way that that's possible. We're going to end up with so many lawsuits. You have situations where some states can participate in a recount and others can't, or maybe... Everybody, you know, maybe states get really, really lenient about their recount provisions so that more people can participate. But then you've got situations where Florida's counting a hanging chad this way, Ohio's counting it that way. Texas got in, by the way, not because they need a recount, but just because they could see it's not going their way, and so they're going to count the hanging chads this way. I mean, it just sets up so many possibilities for so much chaos. Now, I am in favor of the Electoral College. I think we should keep it, but if we're going to get rid of it, we need to do it through a constitutional amendment that explicitly empowers Congress to set up one federal election code to deal with all of this stuff so everybody is operating under the same set of laws. I mean, National Popular Vote, you know, they say they're doing this to have a more democratic system. The most basic rule of democracy is everybody cast a ballot under the same set of laws as the person right next to them. And they're violating that right from the get-go.
Well, that's a very interesting point. I don't think I've heard anyone make that before quite the way that you did. We've got 51 different electoral systems here, and a national popular vote solution would leave those electoral systems in place, and therefore you're predicting chaos.
I don't see any other alternative. I think what will happen is that in real life, what will happen is the national popular vote people will try to get an election code through Congress anyway. I don't know what will happen with that. There's an awful lot of states that don't like this plan, don't want to participate in it, will vote against this if they think they can at all. At a minimum, you're forcing people to vote for a law to create a problem that you didn't want in the first place, which is kind of undemocratic by itself. Worst case scenario is you can't make states like Texas participate. You know, I mean, if a state like Texas wanted to get really difficult, which I don't know if they would, but if they wanted to, they could do something like change their way of voting so we're not using a short presidential ballot anymore, like most states do. But instead, in Texas, perhaps I get 38 votes, so I can vote for 38 individuals for electors. And you don't know if I voted for 38 Republicans or 38 Democrats or half of each or a third of, you know, a third Republican, a third Democrat, and a third party. You don't know who I voted for. So there is no national, there's no tally, no popular vote tally in Texas at all. I mean, it's just...
Or you mean states would actually try to obfuscate the popular vote tally within their states in order to thwart the other, the NPV states, from being able to even calculate a popular vote?
Sure. All of this is possible. All of this is possible because of the way the national popular vote is going through this. Because they are... basically doing, I know they'll deny it, but they're doing an end run around the constitutional amendment process, and they're just trying to force everybody else to do this idea that they have. I mean, again, I think we should keep the Electoral College, but if we're not going to, the way we should do it is we should have a national debate. We should convince everybody, look, pure democracy is better than democracy plus federalism, and let's go ahead and let's get the amendment, let's get it ratified, everybody on board. Then none of this stuff that I'm describing is possible. None of the constitutional challenges that I didn't even touch on yet are possible. We'll just all agree as a nation that, you know, we're tired of doing this democracy plus federalism thing. So it's more coherent. It is better for the health of our country, I think, to go forward in a relatively unified fashion as opposed to this effort where a handful of states just decide for everybody else this is what we're going to do and then kick back and wait and see if anybody does anything about it. And well, by the way, you know, even if you've got a state like Massachusetts has already joined this compact, do we really trust them that they're going to just stay in the compact even if they can see their electors are about to all go to Sarah Palin? Do we really think that's going to happen, or do we think they're going to pull out and possibly we end up in a situation where we're switching back and forth between the Electoral College and NPV? You know, a good thing.
Well, I think it would be, and not to take their side, but I think that it would probably be hard for any state to change its electoral law in the midst of an election. Now, they might decide if in fact Massachusetts were giving all of its electoral votes to Sarah Palin next year, they might very well decide that they're going to change it for the next election, and they might pull out of the compact. But I don't think they could in the midst of a presidential election.
I'll say two things to that. One is before, I think, I want to say it's July 20th. It's in the middle of July. The compact explicitly states they can pull out. So, in, you know, July 1st of 2012, there's nothing at all legally stopping Massachusetts from just saying, we're out of here. The second thing I'll say is if Massachusetts decides it's going to leave in, say, September 2012, they're not just going to say, oh, please may I get out and just bow out grace. You know, they're not going to ask for permission. They're going to file a lawsuit that says, you know what, this compact was unconstitutional to begin with. And so it can't bind us. You know, Article 2 gives us explicit authority to do what we're going to want to do, and we're not doing this. So I don't – and then that will just be, again, another legal problem that is holding up the decision about how our election is going to come out. You know, and I think I use Massachusetts deliberately just because Massachusetts has shown its willingness to flip-flop back and forth in Senate races and such based on how – they're going to, how they perceive it coming out for a particular political
party.
Well,
Tara, you paint a bleak picture. Voter-geddon might be a good description of it. But the big, of course, the hardest question for your side to answer is, what about 2000? What about the Gore-Bush race? What about the other races in our history where the popular vote has been on the losing side of a presidential election? Isn't any such system, including our current electoral college, isn't it ultimately indefensible when it occasionally leads to such anti-democratic results?
Well, I don't think so. I know they say there's four elections that way. I would say there's two. We could talk more about that if you want to. There's two, 1888 and 2000. To me, those elections are not problems. They are demonstrations of candidates that should have won, probably, who failed to do what the Electoral College incentivizes people to do, which is to build national coalitions. In 1888, Grover Cleveland ran a campaign that was really heavily, well, the perception of it during the election was that it was really aimed at the South. And he had very high margins of victory in the South and really did not do well anyplace else in the country. And I don't think he would have been a good representative for the country, relying that heavily on one region of the country to win the vote. I think in 2000, you know, probably Gore should have won. You know, he was essentially the incumbent. You know, he was the vice president. Economy's doing well. But I think he did not appeal to a wide variety of people, which is why you see that map that people send around with all the, you know, red counties and the blue counties, and there's way more red counties than blue counties. I think it just demonstrates that he needed to do a better job. He just needed to do a better job of taking into account the fact that this is a big, diverse nation. And, you know, the results were really close. Bush squeaked it out. And I think that's just the way it was. And I hope future presidential candidates learn from that, because we need a particular kind of candidate to serve as the country for our really unique nation.
Well, Tara Ross, thank you very much for your time today. We especially appreciate your being on the show, given that you will shortly be bringing in another bundle of joy. We wish you the very best of luck with your pregnancy.
Sooner rather than later.
Sooner rather than later.
Running out of room here. Yep.
Best of luck with that, and thank you for sharing your arguments in favor of our Electoral College with us today. Well, that was a fascinating discussion with Tara Ross, the author of Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College. Earlier, of course, we spoke to Dr. John R. Koza, who is the proponent and the inventor of the National Popular Vote Reform of the Electoral College. And now let's have our Madison Minute.
James Madison's most publicized friendship is undoubtedly with Thomas Jefferson. But Madison also found a companion and mentor in another Virginian, George Washington. Following their initial meeting in 1781, the two men collaborated to shape the new nation's government. Washington so trusted Madison that when Washington contemplated his retirement, he relied on Madison to draft his farewell address. Madison's notes state that Washington wished to advise with me on the mode and time most proper for making known that intention of retiring from the presidency. He said he had spoken with no one yet on those particular points and took this opportunity of mentioning them to me, that I might consider the matter and give him my opinion. Madison's 1792 draft served as the foundation for Washington's eventual farewell address, which he made public in September 1796. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
And so now I'm turning back to young Benjamin Harris, who's in the studio with me today. Ben, you've heard both sides now. Are you convinced either way? What's your opinion of this?
I'd have to say I'm persuaded by Dr. Coase on this one. I really think that we should effectively abolish the Electoral College.
Really?
Well, yeah, and not just for the reason he really was big on, the fact that most states are ignored in a presidential election. It's only the battleground states. But also for two other reasons in the Electoral College.
Okay.
Well, the first one is a fundamental misrepresentation of the American electorate.
Mm-hmm.
It's better with an example. So take the state of California. Mm-hmm. It has 55 electoral votes with a population of around 37 million people. And remember, that's its number of representatives plus senators. But then look at the six southern states of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Arkansas, and Tennessee. Combined, they have 56 electoral votes. But because that's the number of representatives and senators, that represents 31 million people. So even though they have 6 million less people than California combined, they have one more electoral vote.
So fewer people have more power in the Electoral College just because they're divided up and...
But probably the biggest example, especially relating to modern times, is the election of 1876 between Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel Tilden. Now, this was just 10 years after the Civil War, and the South is still undergoing Reconstruction. So the Democratic candidate, Tilden... the South was heavily Democratic, and he polled very strongly in the South. And Rutherford B. Hayes polled very strongly in the North.
He was a Republican.
Republican Rutherford B. Hayes.
Right.
At the end of the day, Tilden had 250,000 more votes, but was one vote shy of the electoral majority he needed. On the other hand, Rutherford B. Hayes was 20 votes shy, but there were 20 disputed electoral votes. Arising from various electoral situations in the state because of Reconstruction, people weren't sure exactly who the electoral vote should go to.
That's because everything was in chaos in the South.
It was complete chaos.
Okay.
And so what happened is that...
How did they resolve that then?
Well, the thing is that the one of the problems with the Electoral College, it doesn't have a provision for what happens when they don't know how to count the ballots. So Congress got together, and one house, the Senate, was very heavily Republican, and the House of Representatives was very heavily Democratic. So what happened is they agreed to create a commission with members from both houses and five from the Supreme Court to decide this. There were three Republicans from the House... three Democrats from the House, two Republicans, three Republicans from the Senate, and two Democrats, and then the five members of the court would make up the deciding vote. There were two from either party, and so the entire election, the entire election hinged on the appointment of one more man. This man, Joseph P. Bradley, was supposedly an independent. Turns out he was a Republican all along, and every decision about each electoral vote disputed, 8-7 decision, the Republicans managed to win, and Hayes
was elected
president.
Wait a second. There are 20 disputed electoral votes.
And if Tilden got one of them, he would have been elected.
Tilden only needed one to win, but 20 of those decisions all went to Hayes.
8-7, every one of them.
8-7, every one. My goodness. And they formed a super committee.
Well, and not only that, but in order to pacify the Democrats, Hayes basically had to agree to end Reconstruction.
Wait a minute. So Hayes wins.
Hayes wins.
Okay, because the Republicans vote along straight party lines.
Exactly.
Okay. So the South is not happy.
Yes, and this has to be approved by the House of Representatives.
Right.
And so in order to get House approval for this, Hayes has to make concessions, and one of them is ending Reconstruction far before the nation was ready to end Reconstruction.
Oh.
And so for the next 100 years, you have a restriction of black voting rights in the South.
Well, we're just about out of time, Ben, but one last question. Do you actually remember going with me down to the Supervisor of Elections office in Florida and watching this recount in 2000?
I remember a beautiful sunny Saturday where I was going to watch my cartoons and play outside, and instead being dragged to watch a bunch of old men pull names out of a hat. And a recount that never actually mattered in the first place.
So that was your inspiration for getting to become our local expert in the Electoral College, eh?
Yeah, what an inspiration it was.
Thank you, Benjamin Harris, and thank you also to our guests, Tara Ross and Dr. John R. Koza. My name is Stuart Harris. This is your weekly Constitutional. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it. Hey, you don't just have to listen to us when we broadcast. You can listen to us on iTunes if you prefer. You can also visit us on Facebook. You can visit us on Twitter. Heck, we're just all over the internet. So please, turn on your computer and type in your weekly Constitutional. See what you get.